Only Dick Evans would spend more time introducing somebody than receiving an honor. And as he mentioned, I had the privilege of being educated at the U.S. Naval Academy. We had a what we call John Paul Jones's Creed, which is what a gentleman, an officer was. It was somebody who was a man of refined manners, punctilious courtesy, and the nicest sense of personal honor. That's Dick Evans. But I must be at the wrong dinner because my little program says Intergalactic Citizen Award, not International Citizen Award. So, Dick, I mean, there's nobody better. I've had the privilege of working with Dick. He has been on the San Antonio Board of the Federal Reserve, one of our great branches. He served on the board of the Dallas Fed. He's been on the Federal Advisory Committee, as you mentioned earlier, and has just been an indispensable advisor and friend. And I was looking over this list of the honorees who have received this great honor, but as a speaker, what my staff gave me was the people that have preceded me, Governor Chuck Robb, Paul Volcker, the giant of central banking in the world, Dick Cheney, Zbigniew Brzezinski, one of my favorites, Elsbeth Rostow, Prince Bandar, my former partner Henry Kissinger, President Gerald Ford, Jim Baker. And on the way down here, I told my wife, Nancy, who couldn't be with us tonight, she has a broken shoulder, I said, this is hard to believe. I'm coming to honor Dick Evans, but I want to read to you the list of people who have preceded me as speaker. In your wildest dreams, could you ever imagine that your husband would be speaking to such a distinguished group and follow in the footsteps of these great men and women? You'll love her answer. She said, Richard, we've been married 40 years. You don't appear in my wildest dreams. So, I have been put in my place. I mentioned Jim Baker. I noticed he's spoken at this event, one of the great public servants and, of course, a great Texan. And it was Jim Baker who told me a story, which I will begin this very short after-dinner speech with, but I think it puts things in perspective. And the story was about one of the greatest public servants, I think, in our American history, named George Shultz. I don't think there is anybody who has served in more cabinet positions than Mr. Shultz. He was head of the Office of Management and Budget under President Nixon, then became Secretary of Labor, became Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of State. There's no office that George Shultz has not held. He even outdid Jim Baker. And during President Nixon's time, when he was head of OMB, we were beginning to run very tiny deficits, maybe several hundred million dollars, if you can imagine that. And this really worried George Shultz. He was head of OMB. And so he called into his office a man who had been there at the founding, who knew more about budgetary matters than anybody else. He was an encyclopedia of the budget issues. And this was late at night, according to the way Jim tells the story. And Mr. Shultz said, now just tell me, between you and me, we're working for a Republican president. But is there any real difference between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to spending money? And being a good bureaucrat, this man who he asked the question of said, well, Mr. Shultz, let me think about this overnight. Let me study the matter and do my research. Next morning, he comes into the office, and he said, I did my research, and there is one difference between Democrats and Republicans in Congress when it comes to spending money. Democrats enjoy it more. That's the only difference that he could detect. Now, so as far as where we stand in this country, you know how horrid things are in Washington. I'm a central banker. I work for the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. I'm one of 12 bank presidents. There are 12 of us that sit together with the seven governors. The chairman of the Board of Governors is a man named Ben Bernanke, who listens to Dick very carefully. Doesn't always like what Dick tells him, but listens to him very carefully. And the 19 of us, the 12 bankers plus the seven governors, chaired by Ben Bernanke, sit at the same table every 6 weeks and we hash out monetary policy. The collective decision, which, to be fair, I have not been in favor of and I've argued against for quite some time, has been for us to run a very accommodative monetary policy. The purpose of it was to pull the economy up and to provide the fuel for economic recovery after a great financial crisis, a crisis that shook the world to its foundation and nearly destroyed our economy. And so we cut interest rates to zero, and then we took our balance sheet from $890 billion to where it is now, which is about $3.2 trillion, by buying government bonds and mortgage-backed securities. We've provided the fuel for economic recovery. We've provided, to use a simple analogy, very high-octane, dirt-cheap gasoline for the motor of the U.S. economy. The problem is that given the way our government has behaved, Republicans and Democrats, I think they're equally bad, have not provided an incentive, either in Congress, which controls the purse strings, or led by the executive, to take the cheap fuel that we've provided and step on the accelerator of the economy and move it forward to create jobs. We have on our balance sheets at the 12 Federal Reserve banks, from banks like Frost Bank and others, $1.6 trillion plus in excess reserves. We pay these bankers 0.25% a year. They'd much rather be making loans at 4 or 6 or whatever percent is appropriate. But they're not incentivized to do it, in part because those that would like to have that money are not incentivized to borrow it. We have a dual mandate at the Federal Reserve. We are, by act of Congress, left alone as long as we preserve price stability, which is quite stable right now and has been for some time and is actually coming down. That's the good news. But we're required also under the law passed by the Congress of the United States in order to be left alone to drive our monetary policy to create maximum employment. And I would submit that that's not possible using monetary policy alone. People have to be incentivized to use the money that we make available to make the fuel that we fill the tank with feed into the accelerator of the economy and job creation. And that is simply not happening. So my greatest concern is the image of my country, the image of my country abroad, in a world which is suffering from slow economic growth, where every central bank in the world, whether it's the Federal Reserve of the United States or the Bank of England or the European Central Bank and others who follow in our footsteps as the key drivers in decision-making, the Bank of Japan, all of whom are providing maximum so-called accommodation, all the fuel they can provide at the lowest possible rates, and yet the economy is not accelerating forward. I would submit to you that they're not accelerating forward because the principal economy in the world, the driver of the world economy, is not moving. China is not the driver of the world economy. Europe does not drive the world economy. The United States drives the world economy. And we're sitting still in the water. And it's up to our elected officials to get the incentives right. We talked about globalization. We at the Dallas Fed put together the Center for Globalization and Monetary Policy. When I took this job, Dick, if you had taken the word globalization and monetary policy and Googled it, those two words, or one phrase, globalization, monetary policy, you would have had 33 hits. Now you probably have 33 million, or countless, page after page after page. My assistant Jared Vaughn and I went through that this evening up in our room upstairs. We couldn't count the number of references. Everybody depends on the United States to drive the machine, and we're sitting foul. With the exception of Texas, we are blessed to be Texans. We've outperformed the United States for the last 22 years. For the last 22 years, we have outgrown the United States in job creation in every income category. The New York Times likes to tease me and say, well, Fisher may have a point about Texas. He loves to give a little Texas brag. But Texas has created the most low-income jobs in America. I always say, you know, you're right. But we also created the most middle-income jobs in America and the most high-paying jobs in America. In every income quartile, and Dick, there are 4 quartiles. In every income quartile, we have outperformed the United States. And in fact, in the middle 2 income quartiles, jobs have been destroyed in America. We are the job-creating mecca of the United States. in the most powerful country in the world. I want more people to be like us and less like Michigan, less like California, less like New York, so that we can drive our country forward. Now, Dick wanted me to walk around the world real quickly. This is an after-dinner speech. I know when I've spoken too long when people go like this. And then they go like this. So I'll try to keep it short. I want to go quickly across the Atlantic. As you know, the British are suffering from very high inflation and no growth. And they are just pouring on the gas. They are so eager, I wouldn't say desperate, so eager to get things moving, they had to import a Canadian to run their central bank. Amazing. So from now on, the word A will precede every letter that the Bank of England governor has to write to their Minister of the Treasury. Things are very bad in Europe right now. You saw what is happening in the Italian elections. You have Mr. Berlusconi, who picked up 30% of the vote. And what I love is a comedian named Beppe Grillo, who actually achieved 25% of the vote. He's a real comedian. That's what he does for a living. And so just as we thought that with the European Central Bank's help, emulating the United States, things have begun to stabilize, we now have this disruptive force that is occurring with the Italian elections. And France is also suffering from weakness, and the German economy has just turned down. If the Federal Reserve, only half in jest, we look at each program announced by the European Central Bank, we admire the leader that was there before and the leader who's there now, magnificent economists, good leaders. We watch the packages that are announced. An analogy we use is it's very similar to those beautiful packages you used to get at Christmas. They're wrapped in a beautiful bow, beautiful paper. But when you unfold it, it says inside, batteries not included and assembly required. And we're still watching to see if they'll be able to assemble the kind of recovery package that's so necessary. If you cross the Pacific, we all talk about China. I had the privilege of being a member of a very small group that negotiated the settlement for President Carter with Deng Xiaoping. We spent 9 days with him. We concluded our agreement on March 3rd of 1979. The little group of us stand around a flagpole, raise the American flag, and open the U.S. Embassy. 12 people, having negotiated with one of the great leaders in world history. We had to settle the claims between us because we had seized the railroad stock that we had lent to Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist government. They had seized that from us, and we froze their assets, mainly at the Chase Manhattan Bank. And we needed to settle those differences before we could conduct trade with each other. Imagine that. March 3rd, 1979, there was no trade between our two countries. And now we have this roaring power. And I remember Deng Xiaoping telling us that they would grow by 8% per annum. We couldn't figure that out because the abacus, which they had then, no computers, was a function of 7, but still, we accepted his challenge, and that's exactly what they have done. So, of course, they now are being faced with the challenges that come from developing a middle class and trying to emulate some form of our capitalism. They have an enormous, roaring real estate market. You've probably read recently that that market now is being restricted, but that's where people are pouring their funds. And we actually are grateful to them, at least I am personally, that they have chosen to invest in U.S. treasuries. Thank God they do. They help us keep interest rates down, and it's a vote of confidence in the United States. The other major Asian power that we keep our eyes on is Japan. They have a new prime minister named Abe. He's aggressive. He has basically politicized the central bank, which worries me personally. But he wants to see this deflationary impulse that runs through the Japanese soul exorcised and is working very, very hard to change things. And indeed, the stock market in Japan has responded, and we'll have to see if he can regenerate growth. I've spent an enormous amount of time in Japan. I lived there. My son played for a Japanese baseball team. He learned how to swear very well in Japanese, learned no other language whatsoever. But we're very hopeful that they will be able to pick up their pace. Middle East, very quickly. An area that I know Dick and Jimmy Ruth are headed off to tomorrow. And I'm going to be in a week and a half from now. The whole issue for me that's interesting to watch right now is now that we are, despite our federal government's best efforts, beginning to achieve energy independence, particularly with these new finds that we have, and especially in the natural gas area, is how it's going to change things. The Saudis have cut their oil production from 9.5 million barrels to 8.5, as I understand it best, and nobody really knows. They need about 8 million barrels per day of production and in order to meet their own budgetary needs. But it'll be very interesting to see what happens with the dynamic in the Middle East once we achieve energy independence, and I think we're on our way. Again, led by Houston and the new finds here in Texas and the technology that we have mastered as Texans and export to the rest of the world but are exploiting here at home. Think about it. It'll probably change the way that we deal with the kingdoms. It may well deal with the way we are able to deal with Israel. And I think that whole dynamic here will be one of the most interesting things to watch, other than just watching for Al-Qaeda and watching Al Jazeera and seeing what's happening on television. And also will, of course, impact the way we're able to deal with Iran. I want to just finish this little quick world tour by talking about what's to the south of us. We were talking about Brazil at the dinner table. Brazil was always the country with potential. Never realized. But now, thanks to the giant sucking sound, as Ross Perot would say, of China and the other developing worlds, it has gotten its act together and has become a powerful force, a driving force. 2/3 of the GDP of all of Latin America comes out of one country, Brazil. And 2/3 of that GDP comes out of one area, São Paulo. This is a very powerful engine that's beginning to move its way through the economy. But the real success story, I'll let you in a little secret, is not Venezuela. The real success story is Mexico. And here's a point that I like to drive home to our elected representatives in the Congress of the United States. The Mexican government is better operated than that of the United States. They have better fiscal policy. Their deficit runs at about 2.8% of GDP. Ours is running over 7. They actually put through a balanced budget rule. They have a totally independent central bank, which is a key to success. They have a debt-to-GDP ratio, which is 1/3 of that of the United States. And they even raised taxes in the face of a recession to balance their budget. And yet they grew and have grown faster than we have. They achieved industrial production levels from the depth of the recession faster than the United States, and they are outperforming the United States. So when I think of Mexico, a country where I was fortunate to grow up in, I think of it as a country that's an exemplar for the rest of the world. And here in Washington in particular, they think of it as something of a chiste, a joke. It's not a joke. For all of its problems, for all of its structural impediments, the narcotics issue, crime, Carlos Slim, other structural impediments, and I'm serious about that, he's a major structural impediment. Until they change the communication structure in Mexico, Mexico will not develop. This president, his predecessor, and actually all but, I would say, President Fox before him, since Salinas, had made that country into a powerful engine. Even Thomas Friedman writes about it in the New York Times now with praise. And so I admire Mexico, and I look to Mexico as an example for the rest of us as to how we might proceed, even in this country. This is the globalized world in which we live. We no longer live, as Dick said, in an island. We are very dependent on the rest of the world for our growth. Texas surpassed California 8 years ago as the largest exporting state. Exports help drive our economy. Our example of entrepreneurialism helps drive our economy. Our spirit here in Texas helps drive the entire U.S. economy. And many more people want to be like us, blessed as we are here in Texas. I appeared on a panel the other day with the former governor of Michigan, and I told him that the song, "All Our Exes Live in Texas," doesn't just apply to ex-spouses. It's ex-businesses and ex-entrepreneurs and ex-citizens and ex-taxpayers. And he said, "Well, Richard, we want to be just like you." I didn't tell him I thought he had a long way to go before he could be like us. It would be in no way appropriate for me to end this talk without coming back to what was mentioned earlier, and that is not just Dick Evans, but his extraordinary life companion, Jimmy Ruth. I want to tell you a little story. The other day I was coming back from the Federal Open Market Committee in Washington. I was delayed and I went up to the Admiral's Club, and a little old man and a little old lady came into the Admiral's Club. And they looked at the ticket and asked him for his pass, and the woman, who was very nice but firm, said, "I'm sorry, sir, I cannot let you in because you're not a member." He said, "Well, we're flying first class." I said, "Well, you're not a member of the Admiral's Club, I'm sorry." So I noticed he was wearing a ball cap, and on the cap it said World War II veteran, Korean War veteran, Vietnam veteran. And so I put my arm around his little old lady companion, and I said, "You be my guest. I'm going to treat you." And she said, "Does that mean I can drink all the champagne that I can?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." And then the man with her, the veteran of three wars, said, "Well, I got to keep up with her. I'm going to have two martinis." He was 92. She was 87. They're on their honeymoon. They're on their way to Phoenix on their honeymoon to visit their great-great-grandchildren. So I got to know them well. We had a few drinks together, and I said, "How did you two meet?" Match.com. 92 and 87. Well, Jimmy, Ruth, and Dick didn't have to meet by Match.com. They met in one of the greatest dance halls in Texas, and I know they've danced in every one of the dance halls in this great state. And Jimmy, Ruth, we know the reason Dick is so successful is because of you. Thank you very much.